It didn't need to be a lonely journey, and I don't think anything ever does. And I think, and this is one of the reasons why I decided to write a book, it's just through shared experience and common ground with people, especially other women, you just learn so much and you get so much support. What makes the experience so much better. You become some of the five or six people that you surround yourself with. Mm. So you've got to choose those people really wisely. You know, one of the hardest things I think was to get the confidence, and I talk about imposter syndrome. You know, I was in my early 30s. I didn't feel like I deserved or could wear the title of a CEO. If you don't like something, change it. If you can't change it, change your attitude.
Welcome to the Seize the Yay podcast. Busy and happy are not the same thing. We too rarely question what makes the heart sing. We work, then we rest, but rarely we play, and often don't realize there's more than one way. So this is a platform to hear and explore the stories of those who found lives they adore. The good, bad and ugly, the best and worst day, will bear all the facets of seizing your yay. I'm Sarah Holloway, or Spoonful of Sarah, a lawyer turned funtrepreneur who swapped the suits and heels to co-found Matcha Maiden and Matcha Milk Bar. Seize the Yay is a series of conversations on finding a life you love and exploring the self-doubt, challenge, joy and fulfillment along the way. Hello, beautiful people. I hope you've all had a delightful string of public holidays and enjoyed some downtime. Back at it, though, with some motivation for you all in the form of Pippa Hallis, CEO of one of the oldest and most loved beauty brands in the world, Ella Bachet. Created in Paris in 1936, the brand was founded by Madame Bachet, who defied her times as a powerful and pioneering woman, leaving Czechoslovakia for Paris after being denied a place in medicine at university due to her gender. Decades later, and after a long break without a family member in the business, Pippa stepped into her great aunt's shoes, yes, she is Madame Bachet's great niece, and climbed her way up to the position of CEO of the business which she now holds today. Her book, Bold Moves, is an amazing collection of her learnings along the way, but I'm so excited to be able to share some of those here with you today. Pippa, thank you so much for joining and seeing through those technical difficulties.
No problem. Thank you for your time.
So I'd love to start with asking everyone, obviously the first segment is your story, so way to yay, how you got to seizing your yay and living a life full of joy. But the very first question I like to start with, just to break the ice, is to ask everyone what the most down-to-earth thing is about them, particularly with Ella Bachet being such a globally renowned brand. It can seem very glossy on the surface. So what's something really down-to-earth about you?
Yeah, I love this question. And I think when I read it, first thing I thought about was my favourite pair of shoes is literally my bare feet and putting my feet on the sand or in the grass and just chilling out. It really earths me. So yeah.
Oh, that's amazing. I love that. So good to ground.
Yeah, it's so good to ground.
All right. So you're way to yay. You are currently the CEO of Ella Bachet, but as you did in your beautiful book, I think it's important to note the connection to the business and that you're in fact Madame Bachet's great niece. And you shared quite a bit of background on her story, what an absolutely incredible woman, starting off as a pharmaceutical chemist and really pioneering as a woman in times where it wasn't as supported to be a girl boss. You know, that kind of climate wasn't really around for her back then. And I think she was denied a place in medicine at university and moved from Czechoslovakia to Paris so that she could study. Is that right? In about the 20s?
Yeah. I mean, Ella was, she was amazing because she lived such a yay life and, you know, but such a life full of adversity. And I think her brother was a doctor and, you know, she had a lot of, I guess, medical professors in her family, and education was really important to her family. And unfortunately, Ella was denied, because she was a woman, to study medicine. So rightfully or wrongfully, it pushed her into chemistry and pharmaceutical studies, where she, I guess, which kicked off her passion for formulating, you know, really high quality formulas with amazing ingredients. So She also, interestingly, she also experienced an arranged marriage and had to escape that arranged marriage, which she did when she moved from Czechoslovakia to Paris before the war broke out.
Oh my gosh, what an incredible story.
I know, she's incredible. And she used, the cool thing about that, if there is any, she used the money from her wedding present to start the business.
Oh, that's so cool.
I know.
What an independent woman.
I know.
Way amazing. Ahead of her time.
Amazing.
So she opened her first store in 1936, and I think it's above her apartment, which you have actually lived in your time, which is amazing.
Yeah, it was amazing. It's in a beautiful part of Paris. It's in a street called Rue Lepay, and it's a tiny little store which still stands today. And she lived in the apartment above that. Well, when she was in Paris, she lived between New York and Paris pretty much her whole life after she left Czechoslovakia and, you know, all those decades later in a very different situation. I was so fortunate to spend 18 months in that apartment.
Oh, that would have been so incredible. I think every day how lucky we are to live in a world where our creativity and our power as a woman is celebrated and encouraged and a lot more supported, and just wonder how anyone had the strength to do it when everything was against them, let alone when they have the support around them. And I mean, she had 22 stores, I think, by the time she passed away, and had already grown such an incredible brand in a time where it was, you know, she couldn't even get into university as a woman. So I can imagine that set you up, her legacy set a really good scene for you in your career.
Oh, amazing. And I probably didn't realise, you know, until, you know, probably my mid-30s, how much influence it had on me and how, I guess, unusual and unique female leaders are still today, let alone in those times. Mm. So it was really special.
What an amazing woman to have as a great aunt.
Yeah, amazing.
So for you, you didn't start in the family business. So let's go back to the very beginning. I always think that going back to your childhood is quite instructive, and maybe doesn't make sense at the time, but when you look back and then compare that to where you end up, there are a lot of things I think that you gravitate towards as a kid that show kind of the person you'll become. And your book is called Bold Moves. So was young Pippa bold? Did you have a gravitation towards business, or were you cool at school? Did you know what you wanted to do? I mean, I know you grew up in Sydney, so tell us about young Pippa.
Yeah, sure. Look, I don't think I'm a bold person. I don't think I'm bolder than anyone else, but I've had to make bold decisions, you know, in my life that have paid off sometimes and haven't paid off other times. So I guess I feel like I've still got more questions than I do answers, but I have been exposed to some really amazing experiences and also amazing women. So that's why I wanted to title the book Bold Moves. But I guess if I reflect on myself, you know, not a lot scares me. It never has. I'm certainly one of those people that, you know, jump before I start to question it. I think it's just my personality. I also think that, you know, I'm a really hard worker, and I always have been. And I think that certainly comes from growing up around a family business. Mm. And I agree with you. I think when I meet people and I interview people, I quite often ask them about their parents and their childhood. And I really believe you get your work ethic from your parents.
Mm, absolutely. So it's interesting that I read in the book that you and your brother in the 90s spent a lot of time in the Elabache factory. So you were around the family business and that incredible work ethic of, you know, leading a brand and how relentless it is to run your own business. But it's interesting that you didn't start there. So you studied business marketing at university and then went into advertising.
Yeah.
But did you have your sights set on eventually being a CEO, whether at Elabache or otherwise, or did you sort of think that you would stay in advertising?
No, I didn't know, to be honest. Like what I did know was I wanted to spread my wings after I finished university, and although I loved my parents and family, that meant, you know, finding my independence and exploring the world. So that took me to London and to Paris and gave me an amazing experience working in advertising, you know, for just over a decade. And no, I didn't have it premeditated. It kind of, you know, organically happened in a way. And I think a turning point in my life was when I was about to turn 30, and although I'd had a wonderful experience in advertising, I felt that if I wanted to continue with that industry, I had to probably go overseas again. And I wasn't really up for that because I'd spent so many years overseas. And I also didn't find any female role models in advertising. It was very much a boys' club at the top, and it was a young person's game. So I kind of had this moment in my late 20s, and that's when I decided to enter into the family business, because I realized that it was, you know, it was an amazing brand. It wasn't something that, you know, was like a concrete business or something. It was an amazing brand in an amazing industry, and so therefore I decided to jump. And I, you know, had absolutely no idea what walking into a family business was actually like. I was completely naive, and no family member had been in the business for probably 15 years at that time. So it was a really challenging and intense experience.
Yeah, I can imagine that it would have been just so much probably expectation on your shoulders and pressure on yourself, because you have that added layer of investment in the brand, but also without anyone having been from the family in the business immediately before you, there was no sort of cookie cutter person to look at to tell you how it was going to work out in that role. And I think you mentioned in chapter 2 of the book that the transition wasn't necessarily a smooth one for you.
No.
Did you find that you kind of had to prove yourself more because you were an in-family hire? Did you feel underestimated at any time, or what, did you feel that in general just because you hadn't worked in that business before or in beauty?
Oh, completely. Like, I think I went from being no one really caring about my last name and, you know, being part of the social set in advertising, having lots of friends, but having credibility in what I did, to starting at Bache and no one really caring about my credentials and what I'd done in my career, to only caring about my surname. But what I really learned was how important perception is in leadership. And although I absolutely wouldn't want to go through those years again, it taught me probably the most important lessons in leadership.
It's funny, I think that one of the last things you get taught how to do, if you ever do, is leadership. You know, we all might climb the ranks just from hard work and sheer kind of dedication, but actually learning to lead people underneath you, if it doesn't come naturally to you, or if you've never done it before, is a skill set that doesn't just come with experience. I think it's quite a foreign thing to do if you haven't done it before.
Oh, completely. It's something you have to learn, and you have to be really self-aware, you know. You've got so many blind spots in when you're leading people and how people perceive you that may not even cross your mind. So it's really important to get feedback constantly from people and be really open through the journey.
Absolutely. And how would you advise someone who was at a similar stage in their life, just facing such a big crossroads where they've got their own career, an independent, you know, quite successful career, you'd been in London and Paris, and then not necessarily jumping into a family business, but just making a jump at all into a completely new role and moving countries again? What were the processes of decision-making that helped you? Because I know big life decisions like that can be quite crippling when you've got so many pros and cons, you know. How did you make that change?
Yeah, I think there was a couple of things. I think for me, one of my biggest learnings was I spent a lot of the time trying to work it out myself, and that was probably the wrong thing to do. It didn't need to be a lonely journey, and I don't think anything ever does. And especially today, there's so many wonderful, you know, female mentors and leadership groups or even community groups that don't have to cost a lot of money. But I think and this is one of the reasons why I decided to write a book, it's just through shared experience and common ground with people, especially other women, you just learn so much and you get so much support, which makes the experience so much better.
Absolutely. A problem shared is a problem halved.
Yeah, exactly. But I guess in that, it would, you know, there's that old saying that you become a sum of the five or six people that you surround yourself with. Mm. So you've got to choose those people really wisely.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's one of my favorite quotes ever. And I think it also changes, especially when you make a big life change. You know, people come into your life for a reason, season, or a lifetime, I think is another quote that I love. And in your advertising job, five or six people might have been crucial to your success, but then moving countries and then moving into a family business, you would probably have needed a different support network for different skills. And I find that something you have to keep on top of and reevaluate often as like a little sense check.
Yeah, completely. Yeah, no, you've absolutely got to sense check it. And I think the other thing is not to put too much pressure on yourself. And, you know, there's going to be a period of time where you kind of do have to fake it till you make it. And and it's going to feel really uncomfortable, and you got to get used to the uncomfortable.
Yeah, I've sort of become a bit of a discomfort junkie because I know how much growth you don't experience when you're sitting in a comfort zone, and how the challenging times are the ones where you really blossom and figure out, you know, who you are. And I can imagine for you that going from, you know, entering a business that you hadn't been in before and that was in a new industry, I think you started as heading up marketing, but then to work your way to CEO with all that added pressure as well of being a Bashe would have been an incredibly stressful and pressure filled journey. And you became CEO, I think, during the GFC as well in 2009. So what was that even like? I mean, first climbing that ladder as a woman who's in the family, who's got the same name as the founder, and just generally, was it lonely? Was it tough? You know, was it scary? And then the GFC hitting, how did you navigate that and step into your own as a CEO for the first time?
It's a good question. And I think, first of all, it was before I had children. So I worked, I worked so hard. I worked, you know, I pretty much worked every day, and through hard work and persistence, and, you know, going back to what the core values of the organization and brand were, and really trying to simplify things. I think things quite often can become overcomplicated and corporatized, I guess, and that's what had happened to this business. So, you know, I simplified everything, and I simplified it back to the customer, and thankfully I did have a marketing background, and I understood, you know, that everything needs to strategically emanate from the market and the customer, and then keep it simple. If something's overcomplicated, it means that people just can't understand it and it becomes too hard. Mm. One of the hardest things I think was to get the confidence, and I talk about imposter syndrome, which I'm sure a lot of people experience, but, you know, I was in my early 30s. I didn't feel like I deserved or could wear the title of a CEO. So, you know, it probably took me a year to actually introduce myself to people with that title. I felt a lot more comfortable and confident with head of marketing. And yeah, no, ridiculous. But it was probably just through a lot of hard work, wins, losses that I kind of got over myself, to be really honest with you.
I think that is such a big learning, is our natural tendency as women is usually to undersell ourselves and to feel, I mean, to become a young CEO and then not feel confident enough to celebrate that is not uncommon at all, but such a shame. And there does come a point where I think we all have to step up to the mark and feel and do what it takes, you know, to fill those confidence gaps, because to inspire other women, I mean, the book is amazing that you shared, you know, some of the tips that it took you to step into your own and be a bit more confident and assertive. Yeah. But it's hard. There was a study, I think it was Hewlett-Packard, that said women will apply for a job when they've got 100 to 120% of the criteria, whereas men will apply at 60 and then just figure it out.
I know. We're different. We're just different beasts, and there's no right and wrong. And, you know, I watch some of my male friends who are CEOs and they're so confident, and I still don't feel like that. Yeah. I think, you know, it's just who we are, but I think we can also use our empathy and our intuition are as equally as powerful. And I feel really lucky that we can be leaders in this day and age, because I don't think female leaders were allowed to be female back in the 70s and 80s. They really had to turn into men to get respect, and you just simply can't do that.
Yeah. Have you found it hard to balance? I've always found, particularly when I was a lawyer in the corporate context, it was very, very hard to balance softness and likability with assertiveness. Like if you exhibited exactly the same things as your male counterparts, which is not the point, but if you did, you know, you would often come across as harsh or too assertive. And I always had to balance with some kind of softness, particularly in a feminine brand. Have you found it difficult to get the right balance, or have you come into your own now and sort of know where the right amount of femininity is?
I've had to, again, it comes back to my own awareness, right? Because I've had to learn what my natural style is, and then, you know, when it's appropriate to kind of lean into your natural style, and then when it's appropriate to kind of back off and not be so friendly and engaging, and have to be really tough. And I don't do it with aggression, but, you know, I'm just through experience, I'm not afraid of conflict or hard conversations anymore by any means.
Oh, I'm glad to know you get over that, because I'm terrible at them still.
Doesn't mean I like it, but it just doesn't terrify me.
So what does the CEO role actually involve day to day? Do you get involved in the formulations? Do you like to have a more hands-on approach to product development and brand direction, or are you more operations based? Like, what does your day involve?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, we are, because it is, I guess, education and marketing led organization, naturally I get more involved in those areas. And yes, I get involved in all the formulations through the process before they obviously go to market. Obviously all the I love to understand what the consumers think of the brand and where we can learn from our customers. I love to get out on the road and talk to our franchisees and salon owners. So it's a real blend of, planning for the future and strategy with coming down into the operations. I always say you've got to be able to pat your head and rub your tummy at the same time, especially in a world in what we live in today. It's full of velocity. It's changing so quickly. So, I talked to my dad and he's like, oh, we used to write strategies and, you know, they'd last 5 years and you just kind of follow them out and execute. And I'm like, wow.
Imagine that.
Imagine that. Exactly. You know, but as you know, it's the world changes so quickly. So you can't write a strategy and expect it to be relevant even in 6 months' time.
Yeah. And I think you have done an incredible job of maintaining that traditional and established integrity of the brand as, you know, a really, really premium, high quality, beautifully formulated brand, but that's still quite agile and able to keep up in such a fast environment, which is incredibly difficult to do.
Yeah, it's incredibly difficult. And I think that's where trying to get the balance between, you know, when you're running a heritage brand that has to, you know, reinvent itself, I constantly go back to the fact that you don't really have to change the values of the brand. If I give you an example, you know, Ella in the 1930s, she had to get attention from the market. She had to create a network of people who loved her products, and she had to use technology. And I guess we have to pull the same levers, but they're just executed extremely differently now.
Mm. So what would you say, you know, to someone who's a newcomer to the Ella Bache brand, what are some, you know, words or descriptors or methodologies or ingredients even that kind of signify
the brand?
What are your signature attributes?
I guess on an emotional level, you know, I like to say that this brand, you know, is really about individual empowerment, and we're not a brand who believes in conformity and uniformity. It's very much around, you know, trying to enhance the individual. And I guess, you know, that goes back to Madame Bache's philosophy of no two skins are alike. So it's always been, I guess, part of our DNA that we try and work with the individual skin and its differences and make it as healthy as possible. But what we don't do is try and make someone look like someone else. So it's not about, you know, it's certainly not about erasing your individuality. It's about enhancing it and, you know, trying to give people the healthiest skin possible in a non-invasive way. And I guess that gives people confidence.
Yeah,
so absolutely. That's why we exist. And obviously we have so many layers to the business. We've got an education center where we have hundreds of girls, mainly young girls, we have had some boys who come through and, you know, become diploma qualified with us, and they go on to work in the industry or in some of our stores.
Oh, that's amazing. I didn't know that.
Yeah. And then we have lots of amazing women who run Ella Bache businesses, you know, in their own right and have, you know, 30, 40 staff underneath them. So it's a really cool brand that, you know, I quite often say, There's a piece for everyone here, and it can really become a lifelong brand. And we're always, you know, doing different things and using different amazing ingredients and moving forward. So there's always something new.
Yeah, that would be such a fun part of it, discovering new ingredients and products and incorporating them all into legacy kind of structures. That would be so much fun.
Oh, it's amazing. It's amazing.
Just quickly popping in while we're on the topic of Ella Bache's beautiful product range to congratulate the brand on its 65-year anniversary. In honour of the occasion and just in time for Mother's Day, which is only a few weeks away at the time of recording, Ella Bache is releasing a limited edition iconic collection featuring founder Madame Bache's four favourite products alongside Pippa's amazing book, Bold Moves. It includes the Special Eye Cream, Ultra Nourishing Cream, Firming Neck Cream and the Recovery Cream Intex, which comes free with any two in-salon skincare purchases. The ultimate gifts to pamper your mama or yourself to get that glowing skin. I'll include more info in the show notes. So adding another layer to your role, you are obviously a mother as well now, which I can imagine is a whole new ball game, particularly in the time management arena. But you were CEO before you had kids and then had them in that role. So how have things changed and how has that transition been for you as a career woman?
Yeah, look, I think what it's taught me so much. I think, you know, my kids are now I've got two sons, three and six. And I think in the early days it was really hard because the sleep, neither of them slept. So the sleep deprivation was the most challenging. But once you kind of get over that, I'd be at the office at like 4 a.m. having, you know, been up for 2 hours and drunk 10 coffees. By the time everyone walked in, I was like, you know, had done nearly a whole day. But besides that, I think the wonderful thing that my kids have taught me is to set boundaries. And, you know, I'm a bit of a FOMO, so I've had to really get good at saying no to things that really don't add a lot of value to my role or my day or my life, because otherwise I should be with my kids, basically.
Yeah, I think if anything helps you prioritize, it's probably adding children to the mix.
Yeah, exactly.
And do you ever find that the pressure as a mother is just a hard one to navigate with, you know, being a CEO in such a high-powered role and wanting to give the right amount of time? You know, I think if there's any area where people feel free to comment on other people's lives and choices, it's in motherhood. Have you felt that?
Oh, definitely. I think I agree with you. It's the most judgy part of life, and it's really sad because I think, you know, equally there is so many amazing mums out there and women out there, but you know, sometimes they can, the school gate can become really, really judgy. And it's particularly hard when, you know, I haven't met a mum yet and I'm the same, who doesn't feel guilty. And you know, on an academic level, I don't believe in guilt, but on an emotional level, you feel guilty every day, you know, it's hard.
Yeah. I can imagine. And I haven't even got to kids yet. And I'm like, I can't even manage myself, let alone another human being. So along the way, I can imagine being, you know, the CEO of such a big global brand, you would have had some incredibly glamorous moments in the celebrations along the way, and also some very unglamorous behind the scenes moments that no one would actually expect is part of your role. So can you highlight maybe some of the most and least glamorous moments of the journey?
Sure. I mean, I think the most glamorous moments for me are the wonderful people I get to meet and the places I get to go. So I know that I wouldn't have had the opportunity of even meeting that, you know, some of the amazing women that I interviewed in the book if I didn't have my role here at Ella Bache. And I just love meeting people who have done amazing things. So I really am grateful for that. And of course, it, you know, glamorous, you get to dress up and go to some amazing places and events and you know, travel the world, which is so cool. But at the same time, the least glamorous moments are, you know, you just got to roll your sleeves up and you've just got to do it. And if that means packing boxes for an event, you know, until 1 a.m. in the morning, that's what you do. if that means being on a conference call when your mascara is running down your face and it's 10 o'clock at night and you've been up all morning, that's what you do. So it's certainly this. No one escapes hard work in this industry either.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's one of the big things that I love sharing on this, is that most of what you see that people voluntarily put out there are the glamorous moments, which is so natural because, of course, you're going to take a photo when you're in that exciting, you know, highlight moment and you're dressed up and you're feeling good. And it's the shit bits that we don't really like to promote as much. Not that we're denying them, but you just don't see it as much because it is by its nature behind the scenes. And it's always so reassuring to know that everyone has them. No matter how successful you are, there's always paper cuts from boxes. Like, boxes is a very common theme, packing things.
Exactly. And it's fun. I still enjoy it.
It is. I think it also helps you stay connected to the actual work as well. Like, if anyone only got to do the glamorous parts of the job, you would become really disconnected with the mission and the people on the ground and the actual customer service, you know, the face-to-face part of what you do.
Oh, completely. I agree.
So speaking of the nitty-gritty, the next segment is called Natier, which is all the challenges in between all those highlights that kind of get in the way of your joy along the way. And I think the biggest one that is a major theme for the podcast is self-doubt, often because, I mean, for women and men, everyone who's come on here, that's a resounding issue that you confront when you do make a big life change or when you take on a big role or you become a personality that's well known. There's just so much pressure and so much speed and then this huge gap in confidence, which often people don't project that. So they're feeling it internally, and it's very reassuring for us all to know that even CEOs get self-doubt. So how's that played out for you in your career? I think there's on page 73, everyone who has the book, there's a whole part on getting over it, which was very, very useful for me.
Yeah, I mean, I honestly, I've had so many moments of self-doubt, and I still do, you know, walking into a really confronting situation. Or when you've put so much work into something and you've got lots on the line, of course you feel moments of self-doubt. And I guess for me, you know, being overly prepared has helped me in those situations. I think certainly early on in my career, I can wing it a little bit more now. but, you know, self-doubt certainly gets counteracted when you absolutely know your stuff and you can gain confidence from being really prepared.
What about when you have, you know, you guys have made a lot of bold moves as a business and when you're crafting the values of the company in a more modern day setting that didn't exist at the start and you're the CEO, it's hard to find people to give you guidance on some of these things. Like, I think you guys ended up supporting the LGBTIQ movement, which was amazing, but also quite a pioneering decision. Do you get self-doubt about moves like that? And then how do you combat the, you know, anyone in a pioneering position is going to face the doubt because no one's done it before. Do you find stuff like that really difficult?
Yeah, of course I do. And it really helps me to, again, go back to my values. So are they aligned to my values? And is it something I really believe in? And, you know, working in a family business, my values are pretty, really, really aligned to the brand anyway. So that's never been a problem. But I've got to make sure that something's worth fighting for because, you know, especially if it's new or if it's innovative or, you know, when I worked with Jessica Watson and, you know, she was at the time a 15-year-old teenager from Queensland, I just would get, you know, calls after calls from the media just telling me I'm crazy and what am I doing? And I just kept saying to them, Have you met Jess, you know? And
then she sailed around the world.
Exactly. And she's extraordinary. And, you know, but she was someone who shared similar values and she needed to be backed and she deserved to be backed. Just because she was a young female didn't mean that people had to be so negative about her. So I think, you know, in summary, making sure it's something you want to fight for, you know, it's aligned to your values, you're passionate about it, and then having the support around you because, you know, it is hard when people doubt you and say that you're going to fail and it's not working and et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, I always say you can't live a positive life with a negative mind, but you also can't live a positive life with a negative environment.
That's so true.
And if people around you are telling you it's not going to work, you're probably going to believe them. Yeah. Unless you have enough people around you, you know, being your cheerleader, it's almost impossible.
It is impossible. No, I love that. You're absolutely right.
So another really interesting stat that I took from the book Bold Moves is that it took 40 years for 50 million people to get radio. And it took Facebook just 1 year to get that many users.
I know.
And that really shocked me. Like, of course, you know that the world is getting faster and faster and more connected, but having it put in such a relative context, the business, Ella Bache, has been around for, you know, that whole, a whole stretch of times. And now stepping into the business at this crazy productive time, One of the themes I love to explore is productivity pressure. I think we are made available at all times, and then the business is made contactable at all times by 7 or 8 different methods. How do you manage the pressure to always stay connected, always be doing what's the new trend, always be answerable, and just be accessible to everyone at all times?
Yeah, look, I'm not going to say it's not challenging, but I also say that being in this situation is a lifestyle choice. It's not, if you want a job that you can Bundy on at 9 and Bundy off at 5, then it's, you know, that's so cool, but it's, you know, it's not being a CEO. It's a lifestyle choice. Technology has enabled me to do so many wonderful things, including, you know, spending more time with my kids and, you know, being on calls when they were tiny and I was pushing them in a pram for hours around my neighborhood while I was able to still do work and emails on the run. So there's upsides to it as well. And I kind of could resonate with what you said earlier. It's taking those small breaks when you can absolutely just stop. And I think for me, you know, January is a real time of just switching off because, you know, the business switches off and I tend to go away with my family for a few weeks and then I tend to immerse myself in a education course for a week and set my year up feeling really inspired and having my mind opened up a little bit. So, yeah, that's how I kind of set the year up. I then am really organized with my calendar and really structured and kind of plan out every single moment when I'm at work. So it's the most productive I can make it.
Mm. And I also noticed that you haven't put emphasis on your personal profile on Instagram or social media as a founder, which is an interesting choice that not everyone does. But was that a conscious decision to allow yourself that distance to not kind of feel like you're always needing to be connected?
Yeah, absolutely, completely. And I'm not naturally, you know, for me to step out there on social media and do all those things, it doesn't come naturally to me. It's not, not who I am. So, you know, even to do a keynote in front of a couple of hundred people, like I have to push myself and force myself, and I do it because it's my role, and I actually love it when I get, you know,
She's got to rip the Band-Aid.
Exactly. But it's not my natural style. So I did make a conscious decision to certainly use my voice within the Ella Bache brand as opposed to, you know, my Pippa Hallis, you know, Instagram account becoming a brand and a life of its own.
I actually love and respect that so much that it set up a boundary for you that actually allows you to do things the way you want to do them. And I think that's a very admirable thing for people to have boundaries, because a lot of us don't. Like, it's very difficult. And it does end up with you ending up unhappy in your own choices. And then you're sort of sitting there like, how did I end up here?
Yeah, exactly. And once you let those boundaries go, it's really hard to get them back.
Oh, it's free for all.
Yeah, it's a free for all. Exactly.
So that leads me to our last segment, which is called Play TA. And it's my favorite because I think it's when we talk about the stuff that doesn't really get talked about. It's the person behind the work and behind the stuff that we see all the time and behind the productivity, because I think we do all get very caught up in defining ourselves by output and achievement and not so much by interests or skills or passions. And it's so interesting that you said just before that you will take time out to do something educational. That triggers something for me straight away, because I used to think of that as rest. I would go for a walk with the dog and think I was resting, but I'd listen to a business podcast and learn about my finances. Or I'd get in the bath and read a book, but I would read a self-help business book. And I couldn't actually separate my mind from learning or achieving. And I think that I've only been as productive and creative as I am now because I've learnt to get that distance and just give my brain like a complete productivity break.
Yeah.
And do things that have absolutely no purpose, i.e. a puzzle, which is the most useless thing you can ever do, because you just destroy the puzzle at the end. So do you make time for Pippa outside of CEO Pippa, Ella Bache Pippa, Mother Pippa, and do you do anything that's just for fun? Like, what makes you yay?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a bit like you. Like I'm like, give me more, give me more, give me more information. I need to, you know, hungry to better myself. But I also have a real passion for yoga and massage and jumping in the ocean, and they're my anchors. So, you know, to give an example, I really struggled with this when I lived in London because there's no ocean. There's actually, you can't even see a horizon. You just terrible. Well, for an Aussie, it's terrible because you just see a brick wall. There's no kind of, you know, it's quite flat. And and so I really realized, you know, traveling the world, how important the ocean and even seeing it once a day was to my mental health. So I do take time out. I go to a yin yoga class every Sunday night, and it kind of chills my mind and puts me in a really positive frame of mind, go for a walk. And then obviously my kids, they help enormously. You know, they don't want me to be on my phone. They don't want me to be reading business books. They want me to be engaging with them at their level. So, you know, I spend a lot of time jumping on the trampoline and kicking a soccer ball and, you know, fishing for all things, which is crazy. So,
oh, wow.
No, they've been my best teachers in that, because I don't have a lot of self-discipline when it comes to switching off the achievement button.
I love that that's how you put it, because I think that is the crux of the whole issue, is that A-type people who are high achievers probably need rest the most because they're so incredibly active when they are on, but they're also the least likely to push a pause on the achievement button. So
I know.
It's such self-sabotage.
Self-sabotage. My dad and I laugh about it. We call it the can't stop club. And definitely members of the can't stop club. And it, because you love it, right? But it's, you know, it's not healthy for you at the same time.
Yeah, and I think also when you do take a break and you come back, you realize you're so much better at what you do because you've had a break and you've got some perspective. And like my keynote is called A-type to Y-type because of that exact problem that I have. See, with just so needing cool. to be A-type all the time.
No, I know. You start to really annoy yourself, don't you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was actually, a good friend of mine asked, we did this random D&M question the other day of what's the thing you love about yourself the most and the thing you love the least. And mine was just, I cannot do what's good for me, even though I know what it is. I don't know what it is. I just get carried away.
Yeah, women aren't great at that kind of self-nurturing, are they?
I think it's a worthiness thing as well. I think we feel like we need to put others' needs very high up the scale, and there's a lot of self-sacrifice that goes on, and then you feel like a bad person if you put yourself first.
Yeah, I know, it's crazy. It's crazy. Yeah. Lots of therapy sessions might help.
Oh, absolutely. So one thing that you mentioned that I thought resonated really strongly was that instead of, you know, talking about work-life balance, you worded it as rituals, routines, and anchors. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was really nice because people, I think, sometimes struggle with the idea of work-life balance because it implies this like 50-50 balance that no working mother is ever going to achieve, and then makes you feel bad about it. Whereas rituals, routines, and anchors is just a softer way to, but also a strong way to say it's just about, you know, designing your life and structuring it to help you manage your energy and help you live your best life. So what are some of yours that help you keep in shape or that help you get enough sleep?
Yeah, I think,
and help you, you know, to be you.
And I think it's really interesting that whole work, rest and play concept came from the 50s, I think, when everyone went, you have to work for 8 hours, you rest for 8 hours, and then you play for 8 hours. And life just doesn't exist like that anymore. So it's kind of an old concept. So I really believe, again, it's probably doing a lot of reflecting and understanding, you know, yourself and what is it you need to be in the happiest, strongest place you can be. And, you know, it's those anchors that I spoke about before, and certainly everyone's an individual. It's those routines. And, you know, for me, I work 4 days a week, and I said to the board when I had kids that, you know, I'm going to have Fridays at home with them until they go to school. So I still have to deliver what I have to deliver and no less, but it forced me again to restructure my day and my work-life play, I guess, and my routine. So I know that it's all about getting the best out of the day. For me, it's, you know, the mornings are generally pretty mundane, trying to get the kids out the door and kindy and whatever. So I tend to miss all that, and I just get up and go to work, and I get here really early, and I get to work, and I use the first 2 hours of my day to really do, you know, my creative work and my strategy work when no one's in here. And then I use the rest of my day to do my management and leadership piece, which is generally meetings and talking to all sorts of people. So I've got a really routine diary. And then my rituals, you know, I love the word ritual. It's just, it's kind of what makes you happy and what revitalizes you. So again, I have to do my exercise each week. I have to see my kids, you know, enough each day. And I have to see my friends, and otherwise I feel really lopsided. So it's just using the best of your time, and even, you know, when you sit in the car, just make sure that you are using those down times to be productive, so they don't creep into your home life.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the things that people find difficult in the beginning is just delegating the things that, or just skipping the things that aren't, you know, that aren't things that only you can do, and focusing only on the things that are what you need to be there for. And, you know, think little things like getting a PA or getting, you know, structuring your team in a way that allows you to do the things you want to do at the times you want to do them. It's just taking control.
Yeah, it's true. And you know, not feeling guilty about asking someone to. I know for me, you know, with my EA, I say to her the most important thing in the day is to make sure I'm fed, because if I'm not fed, I just can't operate. And probably, you know, once upon a time I would have felt really bad about asking someone to get my food, but it's just, in a practical sense, it's not worth an hour of my time going to find food for the day for lunch. So you just have to get really practical, don't you?
Yeah, and I think not feel bad about asking for what you need. And that's the role that you have in life. You are the CEO of a big company, and to do your best, that's just what you need to do. I don't think we should be ashamed of what it takes, you know?
No, exactly.
And have you found that having an EA has been a big game changer in allowing a lot more time? And was there a stage that kind of, have you always had one?
I have for a long time, and, you know, I've had a couple of EAs, and unfortunately some haven't worked out, and some probably, and I think it's a really close relationship, and you really have to understand each other, because they have to be able to anticipate and basically control your space. And that's a really big responsibility for someone. And if someone doesn't understand how to control my space, they can really set you up to fail each and every day, and you can really have a horrible day. So I think they're the most you know, obviously besides your children and your husband and your friends, they're probably one of the most important people in your life, because they do control your time.
Yeah, I think it's one of those big decisions for anyone in the CEO or executive position that on the one hand, you almost think that getting someone to delegate to will be more work while you try and get them to figure out how you operate. But then I can only imagine that it changes absolutely everything once you get in a good flow and then frees you up to do what you need to do.
Oh, it's amazing. It's amazing. Exactly.
And what else for looking after the kids? You know, how do you have your balance with your husband? Do they go to daycare? Are they at school? How do you manage?
I think the most important thing for me is I couldn't do what I do if my husband didn't share the load at home equally as well. Mm. So, you know, I've seen so many amazing girls who I've worked with. They've kind of been, well, they have been expected to do 100% of the domestic stuff at home, 100% of looking after the kids, and 100% of being a career woman as well. And they end up burning out and falling over. So I think I'm certainly really fortunate that, you know, my husband and I share the domestic load, and, you know, we equally parent and co-parent, and, you know, I'm probably quite hopeless at some things in the house, like washing and ruining washing and doing all that stuff and being banned from a washing machine, but you can't do it all, right?
Yeah, and one of the, you know, funny quotes from, I don't know where it came from, but that behind every great man is a woman. I actually think that behind every great woman is a man that's willing to cooperate with the domestic duties. And
100%.
There are no, you know, working mothers in incredible positions who don't have the help of their partner, who, you know, they have to be on board. And it's never just one person holding everything together. That's just an unrealistic, you know, goal, I think.
Oh, it's completely unrealistic. I don't know how they do it, to be honest. I really don't.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
What about sleep? How important is that to your functioning and, you know, how many hours do you kind of need?
Yeah, no, it's like it's so important to me functioning. And this is where I struggled when I had kids so badly because that wasn't there. And I think, you know, certainly one of my anchors is I need to get at least seven hours, ideally 8 hours sleep a night. Otherwise, I can't put out as much energy and give as much during the day as I'd like to.
Yeah, I think it's once you know what your sweet spot is and start actually getting it, you just realize how I think some people can survive on a lot less sleep than others, but we all have a number. And just the key is self-awareness and realizing, you know, what is your sweet spot? And then once you know what it is, just do it. Just make sure you get that.
100%. 100%.
Yeah. And then what about skin? What would be some of your best skin tips? Some inside knowledge.
Inside knowledge? Look, I think the first one that I've you know, that's been drummed into me my whole life, growing up as an Aussie kid, is you've just got to have a really great sun protection.
Yes.
Because otherwise it's everything else is a waste of time. So you have to protect your skin. You have to understand your individual skin. So everyone's skin is as unique as your thumbprint. So, you know, it's not great to listen to, you know, your friends who have very different skin. It's really, really great to invest that time to understand your own skin. And then, you know, it doesn't have to be a complicated commitment, but it has to be a commitment each day. So, you know, I pretty much, my friends pay me out because it doesn't matter how late I go to bed, I always cleanse my face. And and it's, you know, it's like brushing my teeth. So a good cleanser just, you know, gets your pH balance and your canvas prepared for the day and for the night. So Just use some really great products with really great ingredients and understand your own skin would be my tip.
Yeah, it's so funny. I think increasingly whenever I get asked about diet, exercise, skin, everything is just, I have no answer because whatever works for me is not going to be the same. You know, increasingly personalization is the best advice you can give people because nothing works universally.
It's so
very
true.
Very few things except keeping hydrated and sleeping enough.
It's so true. Exactly.
So second last question, just to finish up, three interesting things about you that don't normally come up in conversation.
That's a hard one.
I know. So like middle name, secret party tricks, pet peeves, allergies, you know, those kind of quirky little things.
It's a really hard one. I don't have a, I have a really quite normal name, but my brother has a really unusual middle name.
I'll
just share this story. So my mum decided to honour our grandfathers, and one of my grandfather's name was Eric and my other one was George, so his middle name is Jerick. Combination of the two, which he absolutely hates it. I think it's hilarious.
That's the best.
I know.
Oh, that's a great one. I'm glad that came out.
It's a great middle name. And then, you know what? I'm pretty normal. Like, I think what we said before is, you know, I really am not glamorous. I love just chilling out in nature. I've ridden horses all my life. I'm an animal lover. So,
horses.
Yeah, so I don't eat. I haven't eaten red meat or chicken since I was 16 because I love animals.
Wow.
And, yeah.
I actually want to do an equestrian episode with either like a rider or a trainer or something and call it Seize the Nay.
That would be so cool. Do you know who? You know who would be really amazing for that? Would be that amazing girl, and I can't remember her name, but she won the Melbourne Cup a few years ago. And
yes, Michelle.
Yes.
Payne, was it?
Michelle Payne, yes.
Oh, good one.
Yes. She's incredible. And I'm not a very emotional person. My husband says I've had my tear ducts removed, but but to pay me out. But I did watch Winx on Saturday, and I think I cried for 45 minutes watching her amazing win. So animals just get me every single time.
Oh, same.
It's amazing.
Same. We love animals so much. Like, I will literally stop my car and just go and play with the dog. Like, it's just, I love animals. They're so good.
I know. They're so amazing.
And the last question, since I love motivational quotes so much, is what is your favorite motivational quote?
I absolutely love Richard Branson. And
he's great.
No, I'm just going to pull one up from my phone because I tend to look at his blogs really quickly each and every day, and they're just so positive. And here we go. It's actually by Maya Angelou.
Oh, she's so, her quotes are the best.
I know, they're so good. And this one popped up on his blog today, and it said, "If you don't like something, change it. If you can't change it, change your attitude."
Oh.
So I know. It's a really hard question. When I saw that, I was just like, oh, I could absolutely think of so many quotes. But
that's such a good one. And I think it just simplifies things. Like, it just makes choosing joy and choosing to be happy so easy and straightforward. And we do overcomplicate things.
Oh, always, right? Always. Always.
Well, thank you so much for joining
sharing
the story. And your beautiful book was just amazing. So many revelations and practical tips. So I'll make sure to share that in the show notes.
Thank you so much. I really, really enjoyed it.
Another incredibly interesting story behind a household name, and an example that you can be guardian of a brand without founding it yourself and find your yay in many different careers before you land where you are destined to end up. As Pippa mentioned, she doesn't have a personal Instagram, but please do screenshot and share the episode, as you are so wonderful at doing, tagging me and Ella Bache Oz to let us know what you thought of the chat. And if you get a chance, please leave us a review on the podcast app if you like what you're hearing, or just recommend it to a friend to keep spreading the joy. I hope you're having an amazing week and are seizing your yay.